Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Hello, and welcome to New Scientist Weekly, your curated selection of the week's science stories. I'm Timothy Revel, now back in London.
And I'm Christy Taylor in New York. We miss you already, Tim. This week on the podcast, how chipmaker NVIDIA wants companies to use its chips to create AI-powered humanoid robots. Plus, a group of orcas is using a new hunting strategy in the open ocean. And we've got a winner in the biggest mathematics prize of the year.
Plus, how many stars have eaten planets? Turns out to be quite a lot. But first, a story about the future. Claire Wilson has been taking a look at how population numbers will change over the next century. Within just a few decades, many countries will have birth rates below those needed to maintain their populations, and that's going to significantly shake up societies. Hi, Claire. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
So often when we talk about problems for the planet, we're talking about the increasing numbers of humans in the world and how we require more resources and so on. But your story seems to be about the opposite problem.
Yes, it's about shrinking populations in some countries, a growing number of countries, in fact. So that might seem strange because the global population is still rising and will carry on doing so for several decades yet. But it is now expected to peak sometime between 2060 and 2080, when we'll have a headcount of somewhere between 9.5 and 10 billion people, but then gradually falling from then on.
I hope it gets to 10 billion. There's something nice about a round number. What exactly is causing the population to do that, to plateau and then eventually to start falling?
Yeah, well, that's going to happen because of falling birth rates. So as you'll know, in general, countries need to have a birth rate of about 2.1 children per woman for their populations to stay constant. And that's called the replacement level. And that accounts for the child's two parents, as well as the fact that, sadly, a small number of children do die. But in the UK and the US, for instance, the birth rate is about 1.6 per woman, so quite a bit lower. And the only reason those populations aren't declining in those countries is because of people coming in, immigration. Now, over the longer term, the number of countries with birth rates below the replacement level is set to grow. By 2050, this will apply to about three quarters of countries. And by 2100, 97% of countries will have a birth rate below the replacement level. So that's coming from a new analysis out this week from the University of Washington. And the authors predict that in the future, countries with low birth rates, high income, will be competing for migrants from the few countries left that do have higher birth rates.
Yeah, and I've seen people, you know, kind of wringing their hands about the idea of falling birth rates and declining populations. But why is it so bad for a country to have a falling population, Claire?
Well, declining populations contributes to another demographic trend of aging populations. So the second input to that is people living longer. You put the two together, and that means that overall we have more older people in the population than we used to. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm all in favour of us living longer, and it's something I plan to participate in personally. But an ageing population potentially creates huge problems for society.
Is this because things like you have fewer working age people maybe to support those who have retired from work?
Exactly. And all the other people who are economically inactive for any reason, including children and people who can't work because of illness or disability and so on. And that means you have to do lots of things to plan for this change. You have to build it into pension and insurance systems years in advance. You have to reorganise everything, schools, hospitals, care homes, transport systems.
Transport systems? Is that less skateboard sales?
Well, you may laugh, but, you know, transport systems are organised around the numbers of people travelling to work, travelling to school. And if those numbers are changing, you need investment to start helping people travel to different places, like hospitals and shops, for instance.
Got it. So this is something we've got to hope governments are taking seriously and planning for.
That's the hope. And it's predictions like the study that has come out this week. That's the kind of data that governments need. Then hopefully it will give them the necessary nudge to get going on that planning.
The world already has millions of robotic arms working on factory floors and wheeled robots moving containers around in warehouses. But the dream of having humanoid robot helpers remains a fantasy. A recent slew of startups is aiming to change that by developing humanoid robots powered by the latest advances in artificial intelligence. And this week, the U.S. chip-making giant, NVIDIA, is giving such efforts a potentially big boost by announcing a new computer for humanoid robots, as well as what the company describes as the most powerful chip for AI yet. Our tech reporter, Jeremy Su, is dialing in from NVIDIA's big AI conference in San Jose, California, where all of these announcements are being made. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey there.
Okay, Jeremy, step one, why do I want a humanoid robot in the first place? I do feel like the wheeled robots and the arms are very well suited to the work that they do.
It's true that those warehouse and factory robots can do a few specialized tasks very well. But the argument in favor of developing humanoid robots is that they could prove more generally useful in all sorts of situations and spaces designed around the human body. So just as a theoretical example, you could maybe ask a humanoid robot to make a cup of fresh squeezed fruit juice by cutting up fruit and dumping it into a juicer machine before having it play your drum set to entertain your friends.
All right. That's a very specific kind of dream, I guess. But what is NVIDIA bringing to the table for these startups that want to make that kind of humanoid robot?
NVIDIA is promising several things that could potentially speed up development of humanoid robots. The first is what the company describes as the most powerful AI chip yet, which is based on NVIDIA's Blackwell architecture for graphics processing units, which are better known as GPUs.
Yeah, and GPUs were originally designed to perform computer graphics processing in video games, but we've seen that they've also proven to be exceptionally useful for training and running AI models. I mean, they're almost mandatory even.
That's right. So that leads to NVIDIA's second interesting announcement for humanoid robots, because a version of the company's Blackwell GPUs will be used in a new computer for humanoid robots called Jetson Thor. So this Jetson Thor computer is intended to help run really powerful AI models capable of helping humanoid robots learn to perform all these different tasks by interacting with and observing humans.
I feel like some of this feels quite familiar. There's been efforts before to attempt to do this sort of thing, but the results are often quite underwhelming. You know, you get robots able to do a few very select tasks, but they tend to not be that revolutionary. It's just moving a few blocks or something like that. So what makes NVIDIA so sure that they can do better? Obviously, they're this huge company in the world of chip manufacturing, but I'm guessing maybe they've got something else up their sleeves too.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because those hardware components are seen as critical to enabling a new AI model that NVIDIA has introduced, and that model is called Groot. So NVIDIA is claiming that its Groot model running on Jetson Thor could give humanoid robots AI capabilities such as understanding natural language conversations with humans, or, you know, learning by watching videos of human demonstrations, or even literally going through the motions with a human remotely controlling it. This kind of learning process could also take place in computer simulations, which incidentally, NVIDIA also offers for robotic training.
a lot of hype here. So should we really believe that commonplace human robots are just around the corner?
Many companies and investors are betting on that, but success is still far from certain. In one NVIDIA conference session that I attended, a founder of the robotics company Boston Dynamics pointed out that all these new AI-powered learning methods are still generally lagging behind the very handcrafted human engineering when it comes to delivering really precise and reliable robotic performance. That being said, some robot workers have started getting early trials in Amazon warehouses and Mercedes-Benz automotive factories, and some companies have made no secret of eventually wanting to deploy millions of these robotic workers.
Perhaps those millions of robots can help with the shrinking population problems at the end of the century. If you're fed up with doom and gloom, next week's Escape Pod has you covered, which is all about speed. We've got the fastest animal and the fastest supercomputer and a rapid history of our attempts to understand the speed limit of our universe.
Plus, coming up on next week's Culture Lab, if you ever wanted to wear a fish as a gas mask or use plants to conduct electricity, maybe you'd like living in the weird ecological system depicted in the science fiction show Scavenger's Rain. Reporter Carmela Padovich-Callahan talks to biologists about the real science of examining new life and understanding how it works, and how even the weirdest fiction can bring us into a better relationship with science. That's coming on Tuesday.
The following message is sponsored by the UK Department for Business and Trade and the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency. The UK is transforming its ecosystem for clinical trials. But how and why do global biotechnology companies care? To find out, meet the decision makers driving this change in our sponsored video, available free at newscientist.com/clinicaltrials.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now it's time for Life Form of the Week. And today we're talking orcas. And there's a group that live off the coast of California that have developed a never-before-seen way of hunting down prey. Chen Lai is here in London with the details. Hi, Chen.
Hello.
So this group of orcas in California, tell us about them.
So the type of orca we're talking about here is known as a transient killer whale, and these primarily feed on other marine mammals. Some of these feed near the coastline, but there's another group, like the one in California, that hunt in the deep water. Until now, we've known very little about how they actually go about it, though.
Love that. So there's a bit of a mystery. How did we find out more?
So researchers compiled observations and survey data of orcas around California's Monterey Bay, which is home to a huge submarine canyon. They were all observed to prey on grey whales, sea lions, and elephant seals. In total, they identified 183 transient killer whales that were only seen in open water. But it was their hunting methods that was really interesting. It turns out that these open water orcas are really good at putting ocean canyons to good use. Small groups of them patrol the canyon walls where marine mammals tend to feed on crustaceans and pick out unsuspecting mother whales and their calves to chase until they get tired. Once the calves are separated from their mothers, the orcas then drown them by keeping them submerged underwater.
Oh. Oof. Well, big round of applause for the orcas. That's really clever, but it also feels really brutal.
Yeah, very much so. In fact, one of the researchers I spoke to for the story described it as kind of a National Geographic moment. So there's another form of hunting as well. So away from the edges of the canyon, groups of these orcas tend to spread over a kilometre apart and zigzag their way around on long dives. If one spots potential prey, they will signal to their group mates to converge and hunt it down together. This often involves ramming into the animal with their bodies or heads and then catapulting them into the air with their tails.
That's incredible. life does, in fact, find a way. Do we know if this behavior is unique to this group of transient orcas in California, though, or could we be seeing it elsewhere, too?
Yeah, so this is one of the first looks at how orcas are able to make the most of the open water to hunt. But because there are so many other populations of orcas around the world that probably live in deep water, the researchers hope to see if it is actually more widespread among these deep water traversing orcas.
All right, next up, we have not one, but two stories about math accomplishments this week. We got the biggest prize in mathematics and how researchers are going to use a computer to prove a famously mysterious theorem from a long-dead mathematician. Alex Wilkins is here. Alex, let's start with what is arguably the biggest maths prize of the year, the Abel Prize. Who was the winner and what did she or he do?
So before I reveal the winner, and little drum roll, for those unfamiliar, the Abel Prize is like the Nobel Prize, but for mathematics. And it goes to a single recipient each year, often recognized for an entire career of work. So this year's winner was the French mathematician Michel Talleyrand. Here's a clip of the award committee announcing it earlier this week.
The Norwegian Academy of Science and Letters awards the Abel Prize 2024 to Michel Talleyrand for his groundbreaking contributions to probability theory and function analysis. The development of probability theory was originally motivated by problems that arose in the context of gambling or assessing risks. It has now become apparent that a thorough understanding of random phenomena is essential in today's world. For example, random algorithms underpin our weather forecast and large language models, and the coherence of quantum computers.
And as you can hear there, his achievements can be summed up pretty well as trying to understand randomness. There are random processes all over nature, from the distribution of heights in a population, to waves on a shore, to wind hitting a bridge, and they're really difficult to predict and understand because they're inherently chaotic. Talleyrand came up with a whole suite of tools to make random processes more understandable, and he actually managed to calculate values of the extremes of these processes, which can then be used by people dealing with these systems in the real world. One mathematician I spoke with said that a paper using Talleyrand's equations is published basically every week, if not every day, and his impact is pretty far-reaching in the mathematical community.
I mean, that definitely sounds like the kind of work that should win the Nobel Prize of Mathematics.
Yeah, and as well as his work on probability theory, he also had a fascination with these things called spin glasses, which are these unusual magnetic arrangements where a material's atoms can act like tiny magnets but pointing in random directions, showing no obvious order. That the easiest analogy is like glass and the irregular crystal structure of no apparent pattern. Talleyrand helped prove a crucial conjecture that explains how these spin glasses function, and he also attracted a load of mathematicians to a field that previously was only really occupied by physicists. I also really like the way that Talleyrand viewed his own career. Maybe inspired by his own work and topics, he said he sees his career as a random process. I'll read out the full quote because I really like it. He said, "It's absolutely frightening if I look at my life and the important things which happened, they are determined by minor random influences and there is no planning whatsoever," which I think a lot of us can relate to.
Yeah, fantastic. And yeah, that certainly chimes with my career too. You also reported on a new effort to prove a famously difficult and I would say legendary mathematical theorem. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So as a mathematician yourself, Tim, you've almost certainly heard of Fermat's Last Theorem.
I have. Yeah.
Arguably the most famous proof in mathematics. And it's a little bit tricky to explain without having it on paper, but it basically involves showing that a certain equation can't be solved for any number greater than 2. French mathematician Pierre de Fermat first proposed it around 1640, but he didn't offer any proof at the time. It wasn't until the 1990s when British mathematician Andrew Wiles wowed everyone with a more than 100-page proof, finding the theorem correct. But it's remained on paper until now because a group of mathematicians are going to attempt to have a computer prove it as well.
Yeah, Fermat didn't give a proof, but he did hint that he had one, which is what made it so elusive. And then when it was finally proved hundreds of years later, that was probably the biggest math story of the last 50 years. Absolutely incredible. And then Wiles himself won the Abel Prize for that work. So the proof is generally accepted by the mathematical community. So why do we need a computer to check it?
Yeah, so Fermat's Last Theorem itself probably doesn't have any practical value of any kind, and that's something that mathematicians have said to me themselves. But there's this whole world that is becoming more popular of interactive theorem provers. And in an ideal world, mathematicians would have all their proofs readable by a computer because it lets them instantly spot mistakes, understand their proofs better, and use them as building blocks for other proofs. But it's really hard to translate proofs on paper to computers, because lots of the maths you need to prove the really advanced stuff just doesn't exist in computer-readable form. So Fermat's Last Theorem has long been considered way out of reach of these computer-readable proof programs.
But I take it something's changed if people are going to make an attempt now?
Yeah, exactly. So now mathematicians think they have enough building blocks in place to give it a go. It will take at least 5 years, and some people I spoke with are doubtful that that will even be enough time. But if they do succeed, it'll be a monumental achievement and allow all sorts of mathematicians working at the cutting edge to start working in computer-readable proof systems. It's going to really speed up research mathematics if they can crack it.
Now, we've got some pretty exciting archaeological news to report. Researchers have uncovered an amazingly well-preserved settlement in Britain that may be 3,000 years old, and it's being compared to the preservation levels of ancient Pompeii.
Sorry, who, what, when, where, why?
So this is an ancient settlement that was uncovered at Must Farm Quarry outside a small town called Whittlesea in England. And researchers found it back in 1999, but didn't really start excavating it in earnest until about 2015. And then because of some very specific things that happened shortly after the settlement was built, it's just so well preserved, meaning that the archaeologists can uncover a great deal of the objects of everyday life for people who lived there, everything from what they ate to the very fine velvety garments that they wore and the tools that they used.
I mean, 3,000-year-old garments that you can tell are fine and velvety, that sounds like a really amazing level of preservation. Mm. So how did this happen? I'm presuming no volcanoes were involved if this is Britain.
Yeah, no volcanoes here. So a few things happened. First, this settlement was made up of houses on stilts over a small river. And about a year after it was settled, it appears to have then been devastated by a fire, which caused all of the houses to fall into the muddy water below. The mud and the water, well, they deprived the remains from this settlement of oxygen. And that is what would have been needed for the wood to rot. And then the fire itself charred the objects, which left a protective layer against the elements as well.
I feel really bad for the people who lost their homes that way, but this sounds like a really fortunate series of events for, again, future people. So is that exciting to scientists?
Extremely, yeah. What was left was essentially a moment captured in time. It's the kind of thing that archaeologists dream of. So it's going to be a real incredible resource to investigate further.
Amazing. Well, let's go from ancient life to extraterrestrial life then. Tim, if you were looking for planets in the universe that could potentially host life, what would you put on your checklist of necessary traits?
Well, I guess I'd look for the right sort of size and temperature to have liquid water. And then maybe I'd look for the big McDonald's arch or something like that, some surefire sign that there was life there. Does that about cover it?
That's a good list. I might pick a different fast food chain as proof of life. But you might want to add one more trait. And that is, will the star that the planet is orbiting eat the planet in question? Which is a thing that seems to happen fairly often. Like 1 in 12 existing stars may have already swallowed a planet.
It kind of sounds like an ad. Have you been eaten by a star?
Call our
lawyers. Just call his number. Yeah. And obviously that sounds like it would be quite bad for life. So how does something like that even happen? How do stars go about eating planets?
Right. Well, there's one version of this process where many stars do eventually expand and engulf their surrounding planets as they enter later phases of their very long lives. But this phenomenon that I'm talking about could actually happen at any point in the star's evolution. Basically, an outside object passes near a solar system and then disrupts it, gravitationally speaking. So this could be a planet or even other stars, anything big enough. And if you get enough gravitational influence, that can disrupt a planet's orbit and send it sailing eventually right into its own star.
How do we know how often this happens?
In this case, a team at Monash University in Australia looked at pairs of stars that were likely born together as binaries. So this means they ought to have the exact same composition of light and heavy elements. So if you looked at them and one has more heavy elements, it's likely because it swallowed a planet at some point. And so lo and behold, 1 in 12 or 8% of those pairs contained a star that had signs of higher abundances of heavy elements, indicating, again, that they had devoured a planet at some point. So each appeared to have ingested between 1.7 and 8.4 Earth masses of material. And the researchers actually estimate that the real rate of planet eating may be even higher, as much as 20%, depending on sort of what galaxy you're in.
That makes sense. So if 20% of stars have eaten a planet, we may want to downgrade the likelihood that planets may survive long enough for life to evolve.
Right.
Okay, speaking of life stages, Christy, what was your favorite part about being a teenager?
I mean, it was all so awesome, but I think the most favorite part, though, would be how awesome I smelled. It was awful, actually, and I can't believe how much deodorant I went through.
Yeah, truly a magical time for all of us. Well, researchers have now isolated some of the chemical mysteries of why teenagers have such a characteristic, shall we say, body odor.
All right, I'm picturing just a laboratory full of young people perspiring into beakers.
Yeah, I'm assuming that's what they tried first, but maybe it didn't work so well. But what they actually wrote up was instead about sewing cotton pads into the armpits of the participants' clothing. Then they used mass spectroscopy to identify specific chemicals within the samples, and then they had a human assessor use their nose to identify which chemicals actually had a smell.
Ah, yes, the most sophisticated of olfactory detectors. So what did they find?
They discovered that teenagers have a lot more carboxylic acids, which have odor descriptions like cheesy, musty, and earthy, which may sound familiar. And they found two steroids that only the teenage samples contained. One was described as smelling like sandalwood and musk, which not too bad. Mm-hmm. And the other, brace yourself, smelled like musk, sweat, and urine.
Oh, those poor teens.
Yeah.
And I guess since those odors were collected overnight, I guess the researchers didn't even try to make them stressed or anxious, right? Like no pop quizzes.
They didn't, which that tends to be where the most pungent adult odors come from.
So is there a point to all of this besides giving teenagers yet another thing to feel awkward about? Like, can we make them some better deodorant or help the teens feel more normal for going through this?
Yeah, we all go through it. So that's definitely one thought. And another is just understanding the why of this particularly pungent life stage. Previous research from the same team has suggested that this very dramatic, obvious change in body odor may be an important part of how children signal development benchmarks to their parents, for example. So they give off this odor that tells their parents, well, I'm going through a life change.
I like that, actually. It's all communication.
As if there weren't any other signs.
One last quick thing. This week, we're mourning the passing of primatologist Franz de Waal, who spent his career studying the emotional lives of chimpanzees and other animals, to the point where he once described his work as bringing apes closer to humans and humans closer to apes. Here he is talking to the podcast back in 2022 about how his observations of chimpanzees changed the field of animal behavior research.
I saw a fight between two individuals in the colony. Much later in the day, hours later in the day, I saw an enormous commotion in the colony. Was hooting and yelling. And in the middle of that, two chimpanzees embraced each other and kissed each other. And at the time, you know, we were all obsessed by aggressive behavior. And so for me then to go to meetings and discuss reconciliation was sort of interesting. People were not ready for that. People wanted to hear about aggressive instincts and territorial instincts and dominance. And I still remember scientists saying to me, well, maybe chimps do that because they do a lot of things that we humans do. Maybe chimps will do that. But my animals will never do something like this. And now we know that reconciliation is found in all social animals. It's like even social birds it's found. It's not just mammals.
Franz de Waal passed away last week. Many condolences to his family, friends, and colleagues.
And with that, that's all for this week. Thank you so much for listening. You can find all the stories we talked about today in the show notes, and you can subscribe to this podcast on whichever app you're listening on.
Plus, if you like all the great stories we're bringing you, please give us a rating or review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Share your favorite stories from the show. Just tell your nerdy friends. We'll be back next week. Bye for now.
Bye.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.